What up, Kyle? Brian and JJ here. We're just two dudes down in San Diego, big fans of the podcast. We were listening to some of your episodes recently where you were talking about social media and kind of just like that struggle. And we were brainstorming ways to like get off of it altogether. So we kind of devised a plan and put something together and wanted to share it with you.
Yeah, this is JJ here. We basically were both finding that the feed on Instagram was super addicting and kind of gross. So we came up with this idea to get off of it, and you can still message people through Instagram, and it kind of just loses that addiction part of it. So we've attached this project here, and we just want to hear your thoughts, share it with you. And you can maybe share it with your community and see what you think. We'd love to refine it a little bit more. Maybe do like a 1 month no social media deal, something like that. We'll see.
Yeah, man. Let us know. Big fans of the podcast and love what you're doing. So keep it up.
Cheers, Kyle.
Cheers. Chew.
What is up, Brian and JJ? Thanks for sending that voice memo in. Love the idea, and I saw the video that you sent in the email about the how to get off social media but still receive messages. I'm going to include one of your email addresses in the description below. So if anyone else is motivated also to get off social media, and create a fun little project with two cool dudes, you can reach out to them directly. Brian and JJ, thanks for sending the bat signal out. And if anyone else wants to send a voice memo into this podcast, just click the link below, info@kyle.surf, record it on your phone, let me know who you are, where you're listening from, and I'd love to play it on the podcast. Also, I have a Friday newsletter called Wordo. Every Friday, I find a new word and then write a little something about it. So if you want to increase your vocabulary, if you want to sound better than all of your friends by using big ass words, speaking loquacious ways, you can sign up for my Substack newsletter. This podcast and the newsletter are entirely listener supported ventures. So I very much appreciate it when you can donate just a few bucks a month to subscribe to the newsletter. It's also free for anyone who doesn't have that extra cash. I know that everyone's just swimming in extra cash right now. You just don't know what to do with it all. And you think, oh gosh, all this cash, it's weighing me down. I need to support Kyle's Substack newsletter. Now, if you feel that deep in your sternum right now, just click the link in the description below, head over to my Substack, chuck your email in there, and support this podcast and the newsletter. And again, if you can't, just keep listening. Enjoy yourself. Save that cash. Don't support my newsletter. Save it. Hoard your cash. Invest it in suspect cryptocurrencies. That'll be sure to make you millions of dollars. Anywho, that's neither here nor there. This episode of the podcast is with one of my favorite people in the whole wide world, Nick Strong Svedich. Nick and I have been friends for more than a decade, and he has been the director of Save the Waves for more than a decade. Save the Waves is one of my all-time favorite environmental nonprofits. They think about environmental problem solving in a very comprehensive and intelligent way. If you are looking to give back a little bit more in your community, if you're looking to expand your offering to our ocean, Save the Waves is a great organization to get involved with, and I will link to their website in the description below. That's it for now. All right, everyone, have a great day, and please enjoy this podcast with my friend, Nick Strong Svetich.
Kyle Cameron here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
If you get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
And we're on. No, I have heard of the Raglan Surf Report, but I have not seen it. What's it all about?
It's pretty funny. I'm forgetting the guy's name right now. Luke Cederman.
Okay.
But he's a guy from Raglan, and as you know, Kiwis are pretty funny.
They're very
he just
funny.
Has this like dry. It's sort of like the Flight of the Conchords surf version. So one of them, he like edits himself into Joe Rogan podcasts.
Okay.
So it'll be like some Kelly Slater interview or something. He'll chop it up and then he'll answer. So I'm thinking maybe he could take this and he'll just edit either me out and himself in, or you out and Joe Rogan in.
It's a great concept. It's one of the best things on the internet right now.
It's pretty funny. You should check it out. There's he does not take surfing very seriously, which is good.
That's good. I saw something recently. It might have been the same one, but it was like how to look like a local in Bali.
Yes.
Is that him?
With a dog.
With a dog. We're like, yeah. Rent a dog. Is
yeah.
that him?
Yes.
That's so funny.
And he had,
rent a dog.
Anastasia Ashley at Uluwatu, and they paddled out, and it was like role reversal. Like she was like doing what happens all the time to women in the lineup, but to him. Like, oh, bro, like, I think you need a bigger board. Like, oh, it's a little big out here for you. Maybe, you know, oh, this is a good one. Go, paddle hard.
That's a good one.
And it was like, and it was just really funny because he did the voice of Anastasia Ashley, too. So, like,
calling other people into waves is a great way to assert your dominance. You become like a. Like a traffic guard, like you're signaling traffic, you know, you're like, okay, you go on this one. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, of course I'm going to go on this one, dude.
I think my least favorite one is when somebody looks at you and you're like clearly in the spot and they're like, are you going on this one? You're like, I'm in this. I'm like in the spot. Like, what do you, maybe it doesn't happen to you because it's clear that you're going to get the wave and probably surf it well, but people maybe are looking at me like,
no, it happens.
He's not going to get the ball or something. But
it happens to all
of us.
But
usually when you know it's somebody that is like clearly not in the spot and they're like, are you going, bro? And you're like, yeah, I'm going.
Or
why are we talking right now? I'm surfing and I'm up. I'm in the spot.
Or people who give you a full surf forecast breakdown as to why the waves are exactly the way they are while you're surfing. That's a weird little humble brag as well. Not a big fan of that.
Yeah, I've probably done that before. Well, clearly it's a little bit of south that's underlying this little northwest. It's creating these wedging peaks, you know.
Have you ever checked the waves and then checked Surfline while you're checking the waves and you think to yourself, it's just not what it should be right now. And I'm going to believe the Surfline forecast right now over what I see with my own eyes.
No. The only, maybe, but more like to be like, I don't know what the tide's doing.
Mm.
What's the tide going to do? Or what's the wind? Like, do they know what they're talking about? The wind? Or is it bumping up? Or, yeah, I don't know. Probably I wouldn't.
How often are you surfing these days? How many days a week are you getting in the water?
Three, but it's like, I surf for like 30 minutes.
Mm.
Like I went surfing for 30 minutes the other day.
It's not a bad move.
And it's it's like, I don't know, I get like three waves, which is, does not mean you're it's not really like surfing a whole bunch, but you know, I like whatever.
Do you set goals for yourself? Do you go, are you like that? I'm going to get three waves guy. I think it's a full rotation 360 air. I'm not going to go in until that.
That's been my goal for like 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm so far away from that goal. It's bad if you set a goal and you're watching it get further away.
The goal is receding away from you.
It's kind
of
feel like when I set goals, they get further. Like when I actually set goals, they just kind of run away.
Yeah, it's like a girl you're trying too hard to get.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that.
Come on, babe. Just, hey, why haven't you texted me back? Yeah, I thought we had a really good time together.
Going further away.
That's the 360 errors in you.
I don't think surfing goals, like, it's kind of binary now. You know, I have kids. I don't have a lot of time. I read some study that the, like, average parent that has two kids has 38 minutes of personal time per day, which is, like... And then I think, oh, I went surfing for 30 minutes. That was the 8 minutes was me changing in and out of the wetsuit, and the 30 was surfing. So I'm like, okay, that makes sense. And so I don't know. That the goals are like just get in the water. I've actually been doing this thing for a while that I tried to keep up. The every day in May, you remember that deal?
No.
I was trying to go every day in May. I did it a few times, and then this year I did it. Sean Burns and I did it. And we got like every day, and there were some pretty bad days, but it was way more fun than I thought. So that just made it like, okay, you just got in the water and it was good. It was like good maintenance. You just like, your arms are paddling.
Teaches you to just get in the water.
And then you'd be like, oh, there's like a surprise fun one out there. Like it looked horrible. And then you're like, oh, there was actually a good one.
Yeah. You're also forcing froth on yourself.
Well, you don't care.
Right.
It's like you'll just go and you don't – it's like, oh, it sucks. Well, I'm going tomorrow, so whatever. Like, it doesn't matter. Or if it's really good, you don't have to be like, oh, but it's so good and did I find the right – you know, like you're like, I'm going tomorrow too. So, like, you don't get overhyped. I find it – I don't know. Now I'm not as excited when it's like – when it's like really good. It's like everybody's like talking and texting and – making plans and you're like, it's really good. And there's 400 people.
Yeah. About the sneaker days. I think that as time goes on as a surfer, the, quality of waves, it still matters, but the amount of people put into that equation begins to matter more. Like when I think about myself as a kid, I would actually get off on crowded days. Like there were a bunch of pro surfers out. I'd be like, yeah, I want to go out there. This is going to be sick. We just flock to it like maggots on a dying carcass.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I suck at surfing still, but it's fun. You know, it's like, why did I spend all this time doing this? It's amazing. Again, that goal is receding.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay. So I guess it's just having fun in the ocean. That's maybe the bigger thing is like, do you have fun in the ocean?
Sure.
A lot of surfing, what I figured out too, is like a lot of it is so performative and you're like, who are you? You're like, you have this board, you know, you like have board choice. And you're like, oh, but like people, what are people going to say when I paddle? Like, oh, like nice giant board. That's got a lot of volume, you know? And then you're like, oh, well, I want the like cool, you know, this is like all these dumb, like, what are we doing? Right. You know, you're like, just thinking about, there's all these internet, like, get better at surfing, right? And I'm thinking, like, well, how do I get better at surfing? How do I, like, open up my turn? Oh, my front arm's still locked going forward. Why won't it open up? And there's all these, like, weird training things on the internet that are like, okay, get out your surf skate, and, like, that's going to help your surfing by really turning it. And you're like, no, it's not.
You're still not catching any. Well, because anyone doing the surf skate thing isn't catching waves out there.
No. And it's like, well, why are you doing this? Because you want your turn to look better so you can, like, get a clip off the surf line to, like, show your other surf buddies that you're, like, what's the point of it?
Yeah.
But then again, you don't want to suck at surfing because that's not fun either. But I find it's just funny. Like, who are we?
Who are you doing it for, man?
Why are we doing it?
Yeah, well, that's why I can't wait to be old. You know, there's a freedom when you cross over the chasm of wearing those huge bird hats, like the bird watcher hats are so geeky but functional. You know, I actually have one, so I have already crossed over into that chasm, but I think it's a metaphor for giving less fucks about all aspects of life, including the kind of board you're riding or the waves you're surfing.
Yes, and I'm sort of giving up too, because I'm like, again, surfing is kind of a binary thing for me. It's like, did I go surfing or not? Not like, how hard did I rip?
Right.
You know, because one, it doesn't matter. And then two, it's like the chance to go surfing in a week is cool. You know, like get to go a couple times in the week is like,
right.
It's fitness. It's nature.
Yeah. Well, yes.
It's like French. There's like friends you get to go see and it's fun, you know?
Yeah.
So like,
yeah.
Why not just try to make it fun?
Well, you also have a kind of unique perspective on surfing as a whole because you're constantly looking at it through the prism of conservation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing more dynamics at play than just someone who is going out to surf the waves and like maybe has a more myopic view of that shredding. Like you know, it's like I think that hunters, for example, tend to have a greater perspective of the landscape with which they walk mm-hmm. than hikers do because they're paying into a system and they're seeing various aspects of that landscape move and change because they have more of and they're watching animal populations move and change. So they have more of a vested interest in noticing things that are typically invisible to like your average hiker. Nothing against the average hiker at all or your average surfer, but I think that it's just cool and it can provide more depth in the experience when you start to learn some of the conservation ethics around surfing and world surfing reserves and places that you are actively working to protect.
Yeah, I think there's that is one thing that does get me kind of stoked is like just again thinking of the surf ecosystem. And all of the elements that come together to make that wave happen, and then all the stuff that lives in around that wave is super cool. Like I had surfed Scott earlier. I'm name dropping, but it's pretty much on the freeway. So like, but it's such a cool ecosystem, yeah. Right? And then I spent some time like earlier, like way back in the watershed. I'm like, oh my gosh, like this goes out to make this wave way out there, and it's so cool. Like all the stuff that's back there in the lagoon. And then the other day when I was out there, I got out of the water and I look up to the cliff, like right where, you know, kind of right over the reef. And there's a full on blue heron, like just staring down at me. And I'm like, this is rad, you know? And so I think that part's the cool part of surfing actually for me is like this very interesting interaction of all these, elements of an ecosystem that come together for it makes it pretty cool, you know. And that's what, you know, again, like you think about Save the Waves and like, why do I like doing this work and think it's important and cool is like, you know, that's the whole mission of Save the Waves is protecting surf ecosystems. So, and you know, just thinking about all the really unique places around the world, I was listening to this podcast. Or not this podcast, but an interview with this woman. I was trying to buy a book for my mom for Christmas. And there was one written by this like indigenous woman from the Northwest. And I forget what it was called. It was like Paint It Red. It was about growing up like Coastal Salish and punk rock. And it was like this woman that wrote a whole book about growing up like that. But then in part of the interview, she's like, yeah, you know, like, but one big thing about this is like just that connection to place. Like I go in the woods and like, I realize how much I love the Pacific Northwest and how I'm like genetically anchored to this place. And I have like this sense of place that's very, very deep because it's generational. And, you know, and she's like, and so much of the rest of our society's lost that connection to a place and the meaningful interaction with the place and the things that live in the place that she's like, I sound like such a hippie, but I go into the woods and I get recharged or I jump in the water. You know, and she's kind of like this, like punk rocker, which you don't always think about, like running around in the woods.
Punk rock Salish,
yeah, it's cool.
Indigenous tribe. Are the Salish all around the country? I know there's some Salish out in Montana.
No, the Salish is like the area around the Puget Sound.
Okay,
like that they used to call it the Puget Sound and the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and then I forget what they called it, Canada, but around the Gulf Islands, and so they kind of renamed it over the last few. Years of the Salish Sea. So the Salish Sea is like the whole Puget Sound that goes up behind Vancouver Island and then the Strait of Juan de Fuca as well. So the Coast Salish is the group of tribes that's like around that whole area.
Okay.
So it's like her particular place was the I think the Skagit Valley and the river is like a, kind of comes out in northern Washington. It's this big, huge watershed. Anyways, I guess my point about the connection to place is that I think surfers really have that, you know, and that's what's so interesting is that they have a relationship to all those elements within the surf ecosystem that they really know and becomes part of their identity. And so when they feel like they're totally rooted to that place, and that's what I think is so interesting about the work around the world is like, you know, listening to where they have the Pipe Masters coming up, right? And then there's all these things like, oh, it's so controversial because like there's all these guys that are coming that don't surf pipe. They're not really pipe surfers. And that's like such an interesting thing is like there's this whole group of people that define themselves as a pipe surfer, right? So the contours of that reef and everything that make that wave like define somebody's identity, right? You're like, oh, you're not a pipe surfer. You're an air guy.
Right, right.
Wherever, you know? And so it's cool because there's that real, you know, or you see in the big wave world, they're like, oh, these are the Jaws guys, right? And they'll like come over to Mavericks, but they're like, oh, but they're the Jaws guys. And then they're like, oh, it's the Mavericks guys are coming over here to Jaws. And it's so funny that that ecosystem can define who you think you are. And so that's what I think is powerful about our model of conservation is that if who you think you are is attached to conservation, that's a super powerful idea, right?
That's a very powerful idea.
It means like if somebody is going to fuck with that ecosystem, like they are at war with you in some ways, right? Which I think a lot of surfers don't necessarily have a tie to a place, but you know, you maybe have relationships with a few places and it's like, how deep is that relationship? Are you defined by it? And would you stand up for it? You know? And I think it's not ubiquitous in the surf world, but there's definitely people that are like, this is my place.
Absolutely. Any size wave, I'd say big waves specifically push people and they find new parts of their identity while they're in those sessions.
Totally.
Right? That's like the whole big wave brotherhood thing. Like you go out in these sessions where you're like, holy shit, that was scary. And then you come in, you're like, oh, and you were out there with me. And through that experience, we found a part of ourselves that we maybe didn't know existed, or we tapped into this part that we don't get to in day-to-day life. So you're literally forming your identity through a connection to this reef. And it doesn't even need to be a big wave surfing, right? It could just be the serenity of going out early in the morning, watching the sun come up, having the chill north wind blow up the face of the wave, and you're like, oh, this is freezing. Yeah. Or you're like, oh, you know, I'm going to marry that girl. Yeah. Right. Those are the moments that you get those insights.
I think the big wave parts, I think there's like a lot more big wave surfers get what we're doing. Like you look at our ambassador list, right. And it's kind of like a bit more of a big wave heavy list. You, Ramon, Greg, Seelbach, T Fox, like all these, you know, Bianca, Sarah, all these people are, Iski is on our board, you know, kind of like all these big wave folks kind of got it, because I also think like understanding the ecosystem is critical to your survival. Like if you don't understand how the reef is configured, you know, or where to sit or what the conditions do, like you're going to freaking die. You know? Yeah. So it's like, you were like, okay. Like, and then you get this and then that breeds the respect for those set of conditions.
Yeah.
And I think that helps. That solidifies it much more than the, I don't know, I always pick on the like San Clemente people, but it's like drive up to the, you know, the Newport, like drive up to the parking lot, like walk across some sand, surf, walk back and be like, cool skate park in the water. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I just feel like that I just know there's like a little bit, like from my observations of it, culturally, there's Southern California isn't always very attuned to like the ecosystem part, even though there's some pretty radical places down there. Like if you really dig,
oh, it's beautiful.
You know,
I mean, I've been spending a lot more time in LA and like big secret there is there's some big ass wilderness out there, whether you're going spearfishing or you want to go hiking at Malibu Canyon. Like Southern California has incredible nature. You can go out in the Santa Monica mountain range and feel like you're in fucking Montana.
Yeah.
You know, it's cool.
Got all the island. I mean, even the, what you call it? with Avalon and everything.
San Clemente? Catalina.
Yeah. Catalina. Everybody's like, Catalina's like this like wine tasting place, right? But you like walk around and it's like a just a ridge of Big Sur ripped off and plopped in the ocean. You know, there's some really cool stuff there. There's some really weird stuff too. Like you're like on this amazing hike and there's whatever California poppies and like this beautiful landscape that you're walking through, and then you look and like, is that a buffalo?
Yeah, there's buffalo out there.
Why is this here?
Of a movie, right? I think they got transported over there for an early Western film or something like that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was for a movie, and then they like ran out of money.
They couldn't bring them back.
They couldn't bring them back, so they just are out there. But it's kind of rad because
it's super huge, cool. So. I went out there for a couple of years ago for the PSI Breathhold survival course. We did a day out there because the water is super clear on Catalina. Mm-hmm. We took a boat out and they dropped an anchor on a line like 60 feet down. And we spent the day just climbing down this line, grabbing sand, swimming back up. And you have this instructor who's just like swimming like a little seal right next to you to make sure you don't black out. It was super cool to like practice that kind of stuff in a relatively safe and controlled environment. It's a good, a lot of skills take a lot of time to learn, but if you do one of those breath hold survival courses, you'll double your breath hold in 2 days.
So I could get up to like...
You could get up to like 40, a minute, bro.
40 seconds?
Yeah, yeah.
That's great.
Totally.
Yeah, I got to get past 20. I'm having a hard time.
Yeah. But yeah, I do think that there is a connection between people who enjoy surfing bigger waves and a slant towards conservation.
Yeah. And I think it's funny this, you know, we kind of forever at Save the Waves, we always struggled about what are we actually protecting? And we'd be like, well, the wave. And then like people that don't surf are like, well, the wave just comes and goes. Like, what are you actually talking about? And then we'd say like, oh, we're protecting like the, you know, wave and its surrounding environment, or the near shore environment, or the coastal ecosystem, or you know, or the surf break, or that we just had like thousands of ways to describe it, and then we sort of just came up with this idea of surf ecosystems. So you love this word, bathymetry.
Love bathymetry. Yeah. He taught me that.
I got
word.
It. I got it.
So long ago.
It's made a lot of appearances in podcasts.
I still flex with bathymetry every now and again. Yeah,
that's good. But all those things, the geology, the coastal geology, the watersheds, the reefs.
Bathymetry means the bottom contours of the ocean, by the way.
That's right.
Which Nick taught to me.
It's funny. Yeah. It's still funny. Just all of those different geophysical elements that make a breaking wave are rare. And then, you know, we know that by observation and by data, like those places are really important from a biodiversity standpoint. So, you know, and we're talking about that, like that's what the world is talking about right now. There's COP15 in Montreal, which is a big biodiversity convention. They're trying to make a global agreement between all countries of like, how do we stop the loss of biodiversity? And they're sucking badly at it. But that's why I think it's important that every single group and approach can include biodiversity. So the definition of surf ecosystems has biodiversity in it. And then I think what's unique about us is that we're putting people in that definition of an ecosystem, which is not traditionally done. Because, you know, like we were talking about, there's people that only surf certain places, right? And that ecosystem gives to them and they alter that ecosystem. So it's, again, they're a big part of it, right? And you know that it's part of your identity, it's part of your culture, it's part of your economy. So Save the Waves always looks at the economics of these places as well. And I think that's really super unique, knitting together of different elements that make it really powerful. And so I guess what I was trying to say is this, once we got the concept nailed, I'm starting to see it appear. Like we came up with this concept and the evil plan was to sort of like put it out there and promote the concept because that is our mission. So now you've got big groups like the with Conservation International, it's like talking about surf ecosystems. The WSL was talking about surf ecosystems. Like they put it in their annual environmental report, right? And then you see other people like Beach Grit, like tearing it apart and being like, oh, they didn't really protect all those surf ecosystems. You know, like, great.
That was our
keep
word.
The debate going. Yeah. And I look, you know, look in the comments and there's like surf ecosystem. No, are they really protecting surf? And I'm like, great.
Yeah.
It's all happening. So, you know, it's becoming a thing and it's our mission. We're really just the only org that's focused on that as like the thing to protect. So it's great if everybody else takes it and says like, hey, like this is a worthwhile conservation concept to protect.
For sure. And you've been at it now for 10 years.
Thanks to you.
Yeah. That's what I was looking for.
Right, there you go.
Yeah, you like
yeah.
that? I just teed that one up for myself. We were skating my ramp in my backyard.
You both ruined my life and made it completely awesome. I'm just kidding.
That's me.
It's actually
that's the same
awesome.
With everyone who listens to this podcast.
It's you've changed thing. You've changed everyone's life listening. Yes for the better
and worse.
No, I do owe you a huge debt of gratitude. My life is completely altered because of you.
That's awesome.
And suggesting that I should do this job more than 10 years ago, you suggested, but actually like timing wise, 10 years ago, about this time, I accepted the job and I was just like starting out.
That's so cool. Ways,
I look back, I'm like, well, I've done some crazy things. And I was looking at some pictures. I'm like, how did I meet all these people? Like all these crazy, like what the hell?
Right. Yeah, I remember we were skating my ramp in my backyard.
I used to do that. It was cool.
Yeah. Back in the good old
days. Used to be able to skateboard.
Yeah. A couple frontside slashes, a couple Nick's backside rock and rolls were legendary.
Both of those I actually can't do.
No.
Which is weird. Yeah. I can't do frontside slashes. I could only ever do 5-0s, like standing up.
Yeah, you can do the
like completely standing
stand up. Stand up 5-0s.
But I couldn't. I could never like slash for some reason. Mm, so
that was my shit.
Yeah. That was
what was your trick? What were your top tricks?
The ones on repeat were like, I could usually crank out pretty good tail slides. People were thought that was good. Yeah, those stand up 5-0s I could do pretty on lock. You know, front side air, little
yep.
those ones.
Yep, you had some front side airs. Did you have front side lip slides?
No. Mm. But I had front side rocks pretty they were all right.
Yep.
Then a lot of weird like sweeper tricks.
Yeah.
The no-handed sweeper, that was a good
what was that one?
It's like it's like you're gonna do a sweeper. So you take your back foot off, and you kind of kick the board up, and then you like swoop underneath. Whoops! Oh shit! Yes. I almost no-handed swept your camera onto the ground there. That was intense.
God, you're.
I was literally doing it with my. I was going through the motions.
You're dangerous off the ramp.
I know. I would have landed it though. Yeah, you like sweep your foot under the front truck and you catch it like that, and then you bring the whole board back to the coping, so you've got your foot under the board, and then you like you let it drop out, and then you catch it with both feet like and roll back in. So it's kind of it's not actually that hard, but it's kind of a commitment.
Yeah,
so it's like it looks cool, and people are like wowed by it. It's like one of those like, oh my god, how did you do that trick?
Yeah,
ones. You
did you ever get blunt to fakies?
Yeah, you and I learned them together.
Right.
For one day,
and we had them for. it was like a week.
It was like I learned it, and I was like, I could do it. I could do, and then I was like, that was it.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, there was like the nose grab ones,
but those ones are a little goofy.
Those ones don't really count. Yeah. I blunt rock to fakie like really fast.
Yep.
So like where you can hang up and die, but.
But the blunt to fakie is just such a sexy move.
It's pretty
such a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, that one was like I had it for a week and then it's gone. Yeah.
So I remember I was because I had already been working with Save the Waves a little bit. They were a fiscal sponsor to one of my early
That's right.
projects. Shout out to Dean and Josh Berry.
Yep.
So I knew that they were a great organization and that they were hiring a director, right? So I just mentioned it to you. I was like, you might want to apply for this. And you did. And you've done it.
I did.
You've changed the world.
It's changed something. Yeah.
So what, 10 years, what advice would you have given yourself on that starting day?
I mean, pace yourself a little bit. You don't really have a choice, I guess. If I had to do it again, I would spend more time. I think just went from like working a bunch and trying to wrap up my other job and like leave it on good terms to like just like fully jumping in the fire and just doing stuff. And I would have spent a bit more time thinking about what I wanted to do with everything and really like kind of planning it out a bit more. But that's also hard to do. Like, you always want to be like, oh, I'll just take some time off and like, you know, ideate and really make it. I think that could have made it a little bit easier. I'm still kind of amazed of what it was and where we are now. I did have a vision for where it was going, but it sort of surpassed that a little bit, which is cool, you know? And it's just interesting thing. It was like, you had to grow. Maybe that would be the thing I would give advice to anybody that's a leader starting, is like, you're going to have to grow with the organization, and the leader that you are today isn't going to be the one that you are at a different scale of a level of organization. Like, cause I have to be like, I had to do lots of things that I didn't know how to do. I had to edit videos. I had to do social media. I had to do public speaking. I had to do board management. I had to do finance. I had to do conservation work on the ground. I had to do coalition building. I had to do all that stuff at the beginning. And I don't do all that stuff now, cause we have staff. We have, you know, we have 10 plus people that work here. And so I have to be better at delegating. I'm still not great at it, but like, so my job isn't the same, and the skill set that I depend on and the organization depends on each day is not the same. And so I think that's like one thing, is that you actually have to like grow. One of my friends actually said it pretty well. He's like a donor and an advisor and a friend, and started a really big successful tech company. He was like, you just give away your Legos. He's like, build it and give it away. So that was kind of like a good thing, is like, don't try to hold on to those things. Like, you just go in your little laboratory for the next thing, build it till it's like built, and then hand it off to those that are going to take and run with it. And that was kind of a cool message. So I'm really trying to give my Legos away.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot that people in the nonprofit sector can learn from people in startup or tech sector, just because there's a kind of efficiency and like that. There's just an efficiency and way of thinking and way of like thinking how you scale that I think those people are kind of forced to live in. And like, I mean, you're talking a lot like a CEO, right? If CEO of a startup, first you're doing everything, and then you're learning to delegate. I think that's cool, and it's hard to do.
It's definitely hard to do. But my question for you is, if you were looking at Save the Waves 10 years ago and understanding the surf space and somewhat the conservation space, what would you think you would want to see Save the Waves have been? Is it different? Is it missing a niche?
I think you guys do a great job, which is why I, you know, fly my freak flag high to Save the Waves. And I like specifically that in the last 10 years or so, calling yourself an activist has taken on this, it's become fractured and fractionalized due to the I think that, like, due to call out culture, there are a lot of people who just don't even want to associate themselves as activists because there's been a certain fraction of quote unquote activists that believe that solving problems is the best way to solve the problem is by calling someone out and ruining their career. And it's created a huge amount of fear specifically among the left and among liberals. But it's also made it so that a lot of people who have those, you know, environmental conservation ethics are a little bit more leery to call themselves activists or even get involved because they're so alienated with that culture. And I think that you have done a really great job working with local governments, working with people, having a very strategic and positive message that allows a lot of people to feel like they can be a part of that conversation. So I really commend you on the strategy that you've taken, because I think that it's really easy for someone who might still be figuring out where they stand on these issues to get involved with an organization like Save the Waves and learn and kind of fumble along the way. I don't get the sense that your organization is going to, call someone out for making a faux pas, or it's just like you lower the temperature on people's ability to get involved, and it makes more people want to get involved. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking about a bunch of different things, so probably that camera was picking me up like a bunch of weird faces.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point. I did just read like a New York Times article that kind of made that point this morning too, and I hadn't really thought about it because I'm not super on social media, so I think a lot of the like back and forth and like hyperbole and just like hyperventilating, like I miss sort of like, yeah. I hear about it from conversations, but I'm not like, oh my God. Like, so I don't, part of me doesn't really get worried. Like somebody's going to like call me out on social media and it's going to be really bad. Cause I don't pay attention to it. And I'm not really engaged in that as much as we have social media, obviously. And we figure out messages and this and that from Save the Waves, but I kind of don't see that as much. So I think I don't think about it that way. And then I also think a lot about activism. Like I never really probably ever have been like, I'm an environmental activist. Cause I kind of feel like that's just one tool in the toolbox. Like I feel like more throughout my career, it's been solving problems. Like environmental problem solver. Like that's what we're doing. We're trying to make things better. And activism is sort of funny. Like I was, it's like engaged with Patagonia and they're like, okay, grassroots tool for activists. Like we're doing this thing in the book. Like, okay, you're part of the activist. Like, I'm like, well, that to me, like activism is like a strategy to do something, to change something, And sometimes it's totally the right strategy. There's a lot of like fucked up things that just need to be torn down.
Right.
And that's great. But I kind of feel like if you're building a house or you're restoring a house, you bring in the demolition guys or gals or demolition people. And they have the big hammers and they go and they just tear down the walls and they destroy stuff, and that's what they need to do. You need to like tear down these walls, and then there's a whole other crew that's like the framers and the plumbers and the electrician and the drywall people and the cement people, the concrete people, the roofer. All those people have to be brought together to build a house, right? Where there was the old house that couldn't stay there, that was the demo people, and they were great. And they tore everything down. But if you just have a whole crew of demo, this is really good.
It's a great analogy. This is a great analogy. Dude. I'm going for this. Dude, hold on to this. So keep going.
The demolition people, like, you can't have a crew to build a house with just demolition people because they just have hammers. And so you're just going to, they're just going to hammer on stuff, right? They don't have all of the skills to to do that. So, like, what I think the environmental movement should do, and what I think Save the Waves does, that's why we have the word coalition in our name still, is that we are the general contractor of solving environmental problems. We bring together the people that can build the house. We assemble the economists and the legal people and the marketing storytelling people, and we put them all together and we build a house around something to solve a problem. And that's basically what we do. You know, we're not the experts in all of those things. And activism is part of that. Sometimes there's like, yeah, they're going to build a damn port on top of one of the best waves in Mexico and destroy a bunch of mangroves. Like, that's not good. Let's bring out the hammers, you know? But like, those hammers aren't going to get you a protected area that's going to be there in perpetuity. Those hammers aren't going to make a sustainable finance solution to, you know, use surf to make people's livelihoods better. You know, like, it doesn't solve the problem. It stops the bad thing from happening, but you need to put a good thing in that place. And I think that's where we're like struggling.
It's beautiful. And I think that analogy is such a good way to talk about change making and problem solving. And I like the idea of identifying as an environmental problem solver. Because that also, I mean, the analogy brings in all different types of people. Are you a framer? Are you a plumber? Are you an activist? And right now people see that, I think that there's a misconception that the only way to get involved is to be part of the demolition crew, and you just have different demolition crews fighting each other, right? And then the framers are like, well, I'm just going to stay home because this doesn't look good. So I again compliment you on your strategy to look at where you can use the best tool in the most effective way. And I think that strategy speaks to why you've had so much success over the last 10 years. Like, what have you done over the last 10 years? Give me the quick elevator pitch.
Well, I have more gray hair. I'm about, you know, a few pounds overweight.
Skateboard anymore.
I can't do airs anymore. Surfing or skate.
But no, I did every day in May.
But I did go surfing a lot in May. I think we've had some pretty spectacular wins. I was just talking with Chris Evans, who you know.
Love him.
And we were telling the Lobo story, which is one of the victories. You know, we're going back and forth about, like, how did that happen? Actually, I think you're right up again in whatever that was, Men's Journal or something. Men's Journal? No. What?
Yeah, I Discovery? Think there was one.
There was one that was, like, the super comprehensive one that I think was the only story that really, like, told the whole story. And so bringing that story back and actually, like, telling, like, what did that take? Most people don't know about. And mostly just like, you know, it's like, oh, cool. It's either like, oh, cool, there's a park here. This is a really nice park. Or, oh, it's like way more crowded because they did this campaign. And those are kind of, you know, those are like, oh, you know, like, hey, nice work. You guys raised some money and bought some land. Like, cool. It's like, no, I think there's so much to that story. So yeah, what are the things that I'm super proud of over 10 years? You know, I think, the Lobos thing was a big deal, you know, creating the first coastal land trust in Chile and work with Ramon. I'd love to re-engage with Ramon. I haven't talked to him for a long time. Hopefully he listens to the podcast.
He's a wonderful human. I've had him on.
He's great. He is good. And I have a lot of respect for him, and I feel like it's way overdue for catch up. And he put the most on the line. He risked the most for that project. That person has, again, that generational connection to place, which trumps whatever mini relationship I ever had with Lobos is not. It's like,
so what did you do there?
You know, I mean, I think same thing. We just built the house at the onset, and then, you know, helped bring together as the World Surfing Reserve, made a committee of local people that was, you know, local, obviously Ramon, the surf community, local conservationists, some local tourism, government people, local fisheries folks, great assembled group, and then made a plan, you know, for how to protect it and stop some pretty big development. So everything from changing the zoning laws to getting the mayor to declare a local holiday and close the office so that the developer couldn't submit his permits before the zoning regulations went in. Like, it's gnarly stuff, you know? And then working on the fundraising to actually purchase the land with the what's now the Fundación Punta Lobos, Nico Davis, and Matias Alcalde, and a bunch of people that did a lot of work in actually scoping out how it could work, you know, and just being that hub and the trusted sort of campaign partner to Patagonia, you know, to sort of collect that money and make it work. You know, it was a giant team effort, but again, it was like at the beginning we were the general contractors of parts of it, you know. And then obviously the locals took over, and they should have, and they were successful in doing the hard yards and, you know, interfacing the community. And, you know, Pato Mekis is a great guy, and he does a lot of work on that still. It's not easy, but, you know, and it became the first land trust and sort of park model, a coastal park in Chile, and was like wild success. That was really cool.
And have you used that model to create other world surfing reserves?
No, we always try to find what there's, you know, there's 12 world surfing reserves right now. We always try to find the sort of legal protection element to them. Mm. So that there's some things you can and can't do that, you know, people aren't going to develop in it. And so there's a variety of them. You know, I mean, I think, you know, what was I proud of? That Lobos campaign and the success there. I was proud of that. A similar one was in San Miguel, which you went to. That was a long one, but that got declared as the first state park in Baja. So that was a long campaign. So, you know, had to go through a lot of winding. Again, a lot of background stories like, oh, we got all the plans ready for signing and it's going to be this big thing. And oops, the building burned down in Mexico City. We lost all the plans.
No.
Yeah. And you're like, oh my gosh. Okay, how long is it going to take to redraft the plans? Well, we have to get all the signatures again. How long is that going to take? Oh, probably 6 months. Like two years later, it's like, okay. Or, you know, oh, we almost have the last signatures. But the government office ran out of the special paper for the plans, the big paper. Okay, we can buy you paper for the plans. Oh, thank you. Just like, just crazy, oh my crazy God. Thing.
It's so, an international organization, man.
Mara Arroyo, you know, spent so many years of her life, her PhD project, it's like her family time working on that. Gustavo from ProNatura was a big partner. He had all the connections to make it happen. Gabby, and there's lots of people that were involved. You know, the whole surf community down there was super supportive. And again, it's not something that Save the Waves did. We just helped move it along. And I think, yeah, I'm super proud that we could, like, you know, we told everybody in the video, this is what we're going to do, or in all this media, like, hey, this is what we're going to do. So I feel like we have to do that.
Right.
So same thing, Cowles, you know, like, I like the Cowles victory in Santa Cruz as an example, the World Surfing Reserve. And again, just...
What was that victory?
You know, I mean, 10 years ago, I remember starting 10 years ago, I was like, there's big grant opportunity came out, and it was like... this program called the Clean Beaches Initiative, which was a federal program or a statewide program. And they basically said, like, okay, your funding ceiling is up to $1 million. And they were like, in any beach water quality project that reduces bacteria or, you know, like E. coli or Enterococcus and receiving waters and has watershed benefit, blah, 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 blah. And anything that says the word Cowles. Like, it was such a problem. Cal's water quality was such a problem. The state had, like, specific money to go
for Cal's.
Like $1 million. Right. Yeah, just ready to go work on
it. It was one of the dirtiest beaches in the state,
It
right?
was, for a long time, it was recognized as the dirtiest beach in California by the Gila Bay. They had this report that ranks all the beaches based on publicly available data. And for, like, almost 10 years, it was the top list. So everybody was like, it's toxic down there. You know, I remember, like, starting this job and like Skin Dog sending out all these emails to people, be like, "What the hell are you guys doing?" Even, and you know, I'm like, "Well, what are we doing? We should be tackling this, right?" So, you know, we pulled everybody together and had help, a lot of help from the city and David Tarasas at the mayor's office at that time. It was like, "You guys lead this group," you know, and we were like, "We'll do it. We'll pull together the right people." So, we had county environmental health, we had the city environmental health, we had Surf Rider, we had public works, we had the wharf crew. You know, you just had all the right people. And then it was started like, we identified the problem, we set a goal, we set a strategy, we brought everybody in and let them in, and they shone in the places where they were good at doing stuff, you know. The framers were doing the framing, and the drywall guys were doing the drywall. And it worked really well. Mm. And so that you, what you saw was, now we understand the problem. Now we understand how to start solving it. And we started just trying solutions and chipping away at it. And the bacteria just went down. You know, it's not really about the, what does it say in the media? It's just about what the data say. And so like, we could look at the data and be like, okay, this is having a measurable effect. We're doing something. The work of this group means something.
What had a measurable effect?
Some of the work the city did infrastructurally at the beginning, fixing, you know, sewage pipelines, and then tackling the birds off the wharf. So we just excluded all of the, sorry, I keep hitting the mic here. We excluded all of the, pigeons from roosting right over the high tide, low tide line and just crapping right in the water right there, 'cause they were concentrated over the wharf, and that's where everybody would monitor. And, you know, it was an issue. So, and then just made sure there's no other kind of big inputs that we were missing in that, in that calculation. But, you know, it was successful. It was really satisfying, you know. So I think those types of wins are the types, and they keep going on. So that's just three that, you know, we talk about a lot. But there's been other victories, that the Trump wall in Ireland. Again, Donald Trump's golf course is going to build a 3 kilometer long seawall. It was like 15 feet high and, you know, a meter thick, and would totally, everybody there would lose access to the beach and destroy the dune habitat and make climate change worse for there. And it was cool, you know, again, just assembled the group of people and used more hammers on that one than normal, but, you know, got to be able to have the planning board stand up and say, like, you can't do this, through multiple appeals. And like, it was cool. It was one of the first and probably only environmental victories against the Trump organization.
That's great.
Which I'd like to note, criminal organization, because it was indicted.
Right.
Yeah. So
are you working with lawyers a lot now?
Not a ton, just sort of more regionally. There's a lot of really great groups. We have some good friends in Peru that they're like the Peruvian Society for, like environmental law. So they do a lot of great work around Peru, super high caliber set of lawyers. All of them are surfers somehow. Similar group in Mexico, SEMDA. In Chile, there's a great group called FEMA, but there's a couple other like environmental lawyers that are helping there. We have a great kind of lawyer that also, we have a couple of lawyers that help us pro bono on a number of things, but a guy named James Gosnell down in Southern California helps out on a bunch of different things. We've got legal support, but we're not doing that much. Again, that's kind of another strategy. It's like, okay, you could be the law people and like sue and take down, you know, bad projects, which isn't kind of, again, at the heart of what we're doing, I think. The Trump wall was a good, those are all kind of campaign victories. I mean, I think some of the long-term work, like right now we're working in the Azores, it's super cool to inform the whole marine spatial planning process and create a network of surfing protected areas. I think that work's super, super cool. You know, doing a lot of these like cutting edge things, like, you know, I mean, one thing I think I'm particularly proud of is like the Save the Waves mobile app. So it was like this wild idea that was like, okay, well, like surfers are at the beach all the time. They have smartphones. Smartphones have GPS. Like, can't they be the eyes and ears of like coastal threats around the world? And so we made a pretty easy interface and then marketed that of like, take a picture of a threat, geotag it, and we'll be able to like respond with coordinating other groups or getting it to like with our partners on the ground or taking action via Save the Waves. And so like, that's like, you know, we have like 7,000 users for that thing. It was just this like wild idea
that
kind of
cool.
came up with. So that's like, yeah, that's my tech CEO tech experience. Startup experience. Which is really funny because usually they make money when you do that. And we
made
a way to like have
it.
A scrappy
yeah.
startup to not make money. But it was cool. I mean, it was gratifying to go from like a vision and a concept to like a, this thing exists and it's making a difference across the world. And there's tons of people that took the step to actually download it and then post to it, you know, and it's really helpful for us, especially in the places where we work in depth, like the World Surfing Reserves or networks of surfing protected areas. Really helps us understand what's going on. And so it's just really gratifying to see that. And then again, like how we pulled together a lot of people to help get the development off the ground. And, you know, again, one of the first people we did this big gala for a long time that you were been involved with, the Life is a Wave, which we haven't done for a few years. And I think I have less gray hair than I would have if we did that every year because it's stressful. But, you know, we had 1 year and we honored Greg Long for like as environmentalist of the year or athlete of the year. And I just remember we do like the honors and present and talk about how great they are. And then we came to our like funding part. So, you know, we asked for money from everybody at the gala and I was pitching the idea of the app. Like it really didn't exist at this point. Right. And so, you know, we start off like, okay, who's at $5,000? And usually like, I like, okay, dirty trade secret here. We usually plant a couple people in the audience that actually have already are like about to give, but it just gets everybody excited. Right. So I'm like, okay, $5,000. And I know like there's somebody out there that's going to put their hand up because they've already sort of pledged it and it's all worked out. And then like, and Greg's in the front, you know, and I kind of say, hey, we want to like leverage the citizen science nature of surfing around the world and surfers around the world as a powerful data network to do this. Like, who's in? And Greg like looks right at me, puts his hand up, $5,000. And I was like, oh my God. I'm like, Greg, you and I probably make about like it, similar amount. Like, he probably makes more than I do, but like, he's not like extravagant. You know, we're talking
matters.
About like these, you know, Silicon Valley CEOs and things like that. And it's like, it matters, you know? And so like I felt super beholden to like execute on that. I'm like, he believed in it and he put like real money.
Yeah.
Like he could buy it. That's like 5 big wave trips.
Yeah. The Greg's generosity is offensive.
Oh yeah. It is.
It's offensive.
It makes me,
He fucking, I remember talking to him, he like was going to one of his far off countries and he like made a friend who was this taxi driver and he's like, yeah, and like, he asked me for a new taxi. So yeah, I think I'm going to get him a new taxi now. Like, what, dude?
Yeah.
He's like, he's so universally loved when he goes to these obscure places because he just offends with generosity.
It is, Mara from our team again, who's from Ensenada, her daughter was looking for a place to live, was actually starting school at Saddleback College in San Clemente so she could surf trestle. She's like up and coming, you know, one of the top ranking Mexican women national kind of surfers. So she's like, I want to be close to trestle so I can be, you know, near to the industry and all that. So she's like, oh, but I'm going to school in San Clemente. It's so expensive here. I had no idea. And there's no housing options. And Greg's like, just come live with me. I'm not going to be at my house. Just come live here. You're fine. And then Mara was over there just being like, she's like, I don't understand. Like, Greg's mom is so nice. Greg is so nice. Like, they were like, Mariana is like doing all these drawings and had like this little lamp and the next day, like, Greg's mom came and was like, oh, you can't use that lamp. And the next day, there's this giant drawing lamp, like, they had gone out and bought for her so she could, like, do illustrations with more light. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. These people are... So I think Greg has always been super supportive. And I just feel like a responsibility for those people that, like, believe in you to not let them down. Creates a lot of pressure, obviously. But so things like... all of these things, I feel like we said we were going to do it, and so we have to do it. And you know, those are some of the kind of the best accomplishments, I think, is like you feel responsible for doing it. And, yeah, you know, and I'm excited about, we have got a lot of other crazy ideas that are kind of in the pipeline too, of like, okay, you know, another like crazy Hail Mary was like, okay, you know, they made this first, insurance policy for coral reefs. So there's a thing called parametric insurance, and the Nature Conservancy unrolled it in Mexico and the Mesoamerican Reef, sort of jumpstart protection for it, to basically say, look, this provides a lot of benefit for the community and from like storm attenuation. So it's, you're not getting like full coastal erosion and flooding, all this stuff. So the coral reef is really important. So they have this thing, like if the wind speed hits a certain level, it triggers payments automatically to get ready to like restore the coral on the reef.
Wow.
So the community owns an insurance policy.
That's a great idea.
So, and I was like, well, why don't we have this for waves?
Right.
Like, you could destroy a wave. Like, there's communities totally dependent on wave and surf for their economy. Like, if something happens to the wave, like, they're not going to have a lot of time for transition to another thing. So why don't we get surf ecosystem insurance?
That's
so
a we're good like, idea.
So we're working on, so this is another thing. I don't feel like we've definitely promised our funders that we're like going to deliver it, but I don't feel that necessarily personal one yet, but it's starting to be that way. Cause like we've got all these people that are starting to believe in us. Like we got this great guy, Mike Beck at UCS, who's like the top coastal resilience person working on like these types of issues. And he's like, yeah, I'll totally help you. So now I'm starting to feel like, oh gosh, we're going to really have to deliver on this insurance idea, which is frightening, but really intriguing because I know nothing about insurance. And now I'm like in this like mini boot camp of like, how do we learn how like insurance, reinsurance works, trust fund payment distribution, all this crazy stuff.
At first, so what kept me up at night was that no one believed me. And now, what keeps me up at night is that everyone believes in me.
Yeah, well, that's no, it's good. I mean, I think that's the coolest part of this job is you get to work from like, you know, you get support from people like Greg Long to people like, you know, Mike Beck at UCSC. It's like, you know, legend in coastal resilience. So I feel like that part's really humbling, is just getting the panoply of people that you're like, whoa, these people are stoked and they're engaged and they're bought in, and you're like, wow,
the panoply of people.
I tried to say that five times.
Panoply of
panoply.
Yeah,
of people.
Have you seen the Netflix documentary Stars in the Sky with Steve Rinella?
Yes, but I fell asleep most of the way through.
You don't really care about conservation, is what you're saying.
No, I just, the hunting is so boring.
It's just so boring.
I actually thought it was really good.
It's good. I mean, well, he has a really, I think you'd like him. I think you guys would get along well.
He could take me hunting.
Yeah, you could take him surfing. He's getting into spearfishing.
Oh.
It's his latest thing. Yeah, he's obsessed with going spearfishing with Kimmy Werner. That's his, and he says if I were to do it all over again, I would have been a spear fisherman.
I don't think it's that hard, right? You just shoot stuff down there.
It's super easy.
Yeah.
Super easy. Yeah. Just while holding your breath 70 feet underwater.
Well, you don't have to go 70 feet, right?
Shooting a fucking cow underwater. No, but he has this really interesting concept in the doc, and it's about hunting. It's about hunting as a system, the North American wildlife conservation model. And there is this section in the doc where he's just talking about growing up and learning about wanting to keep his place intact.
Right.
And then him having the next thought was, what about that place over there too? Like maybe we can keep that place intact. And then we can
I do remember that part. I do remember that part of the movie. I actually was thinking of you because I think you had him on the podcast or you knew him or something.
I did a couple years ago.
He said that and I was like, ah, that's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah.
And then he had another great thing that I don't know where that appeared, but it was about kids and the outdoors. And he was talking about, and it was a show. He was like, well, like I grew up kind of outdoors and I was outside all the time, but I kind of had to like get after it. And he's like, and for my kids, they don't have a choice. We're just going. And then they're going to like, that's, and it's not like a debate, right? And it's like debate, like what are we going to do? I'm cold, et cetera, et cetera. And I found that I instituted that with my kids. I'm like, every Sunday is nature day and you guys don't have a choice. You can like it or not. That's your choice. And so, so like, but we're not doing, you know, we're not doing gnarly stuff. It's just like, go be outside, like, yeah. Go run around on the beach or go do whatever. Yeah. It's like, it's pretty important. I think it's just, you don't, it just becomes regular for them. They're like, okay, you're going outside, you know?
Right. Well, we think about, there's so much conversation about childhood trauma, right? And people then trying to overcome that trauma when they're older. But there's the opposite coin to that, which is childhood goodness. You know, the memories that you have that form your identity in the positive. And a lot of that can happen in the outdoors. A lot of my memories that have really stuck with me from my dad, with my dad, is him taking me camping.
Mm-hmm.
He had these, he's a filmmaker, and he had these continuous jobs up in Yosemite from when I was like 5 to 12. He was shooting this ongoing development of the Awani restaurant. I think it was called the Awani restaurant. It's a really nice restaurant, right.
Yep.
There.
Yep.
And every couple months he had to go up there and shoot it. So he would always throw us in the car. I remember being like 8 years old, having us do the Half Dome hike with my big brother. It was, yeah, like one of the best memories I have in my life.
Yeah, it's so... Well, I think, like, I mean, childhood trauma, like, the pandemic is pretty rough on kids. It's like, you know, you go and you're trying to do all this parenting stuff and you're like, yeah, my kids are never going to see a phone and they're not going to watch TV ever until they're like 18, right? And you kind of, and then you're like, the pandemic, you're like, we're just inside all day. Like, we can't literally, we can't even go to the playground. It's closed. Like, it, all this stuff is just out the window, you know? It's like people are recuperating from that set of experiences, which is pretty traumatic. Because I would say, like, everybody had, like, the general, you know, challenge of the pandemic of, like, getting sick or being worried you can get sick or being, you know, just curtailed inside. And then everybody had like some economic situation, pretty much like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen with this? And then everybody had some personal other tragedy that, like, they lost somebody, they got fired, they did, you know, some traumatic something, right? And then kids got the worst of it. It's like, they didn't go to school. Like, they didn't interact with kids, you know, they just interacted with their family. So that's a challenging backdrop. Like, that's your childhood, you know? It's like, okay, did how many kids, like, how many houses were just a pressure cooker of those things on kids? You know, it's like, parents were mad all the time. I was mad all the time. Yeah. Like, I'm still mad.
I'm still mad.
No, I'm
I've always been mad. It just gave me an excuse to be mad about something publicly. Yeah, I freaking, dude, it's so important to bring kids outside, make them fall in love with the outdoors, and then teach them those conservation
the
ethics.
The thing, yeah, like they, when they're at home, like, it's just like, no one's following directions, no one's listening, people are hitting each other, they're just like competing for attention.
How old were your kids during the pandemic?
They were, my older son was like three. And then my younger son at the beginning. And then my younger son was like 6 months old. So it was like, he just like a baby. He came out the other side as like a kid.
Whew.
You know? And they're like 3 and 5 now, almost 3 and 6. And so they, you know, when they're at home, they're like, a lot of times they're just not, they're just like competing for attention or doing thing, and I'm just like, don't do that, stop, will you stop, will you listen to me? And I get mad and I'm like, this is ridiculous. And then we go out and I just like force them to go outside, and I'm like, you're in the woods. And then they just run, and they just like, all that drama goes away, and it's like they get to do, they have so much more freedom. I'm not yelling at them ever. I'm not like, no, you can't do that. I'm like, just don't fall off that thing. That was the only time when my son fell down the cliff at Panther Beach. And after, I was like,
Jesus,
wait here for me to go down, and then I'll help you down. And I'm like climbing down, and I look, and I see this little body going, ba-boonk, ba-boonk, ba-boonk. I'm like, oh no.
Nature heals.
I'm like, yeah. So we have this big thing about, yeah, you know, you got to listen, you got to pay attention to the beach and the ocean and all that stuff. So that one was good, because they get to, it doesn't have to be like my consequence of getting, yeah, mad or something. It's like the natural, like, I'm glad he was okay, because that was pretty worried. But the natural consequence also teaches you, like, oh, like, I have to actually pay attention and listen.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I remember my mom once told me that when I was a little kid, she took me to the doctor for one reason or another, and the doctor said, yeah, he has a healthy amount of injuries.
Yes.
Since then, I think I've surpassed that healthy amount.
Yeah, you've gone into unhealthy, probably.
I've crossed over into the chasm.
The arthritic. I'm finding that skateboarding is less, having participated in skateboarding for most of my life, is less sweet now on my body.
But it's, you know, either you have mental injuries that aren't showing on your body because you've, you know, nerfed your childhood, or you have some physical injuries and a healthy set of, you know, action, reaction, and what the world will do to you if you aren't careful walking down that cliff.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good, I think just nature just teaches you a lot more stuff. You know, there's a lot of things that you can go and just be like, hey, like, it's a lot easier for me to teach them things about nature and about life than, like, I'm inside, like, yeah, maybe don't bring that butcher knife over here right now, like, right. That, like, I can teach you to use a butcher knife, but when I'm, like, cooking dinner, it's not the best time. But we're in nature, I'm not, there's nothing I'm trying to have to do besides, like, hey, let's check out this plant, or look at this, you know, look at these birds over here, what birds do you think those are? You know, my son's starting to observe too, the littler one, he's like, dad, like, how do the birds land on those branches? I'm like, oh, that's a good question. Like, how do they? Let's figure it out, you know?
Yeah.
So you start to uncover a lot with kids in the outdoors. So that's a big priority for me, is just getting them out there.
Yeah. It teaches nature, or it teaches curiosity. It teaches patience. It teaches having a solid head on your shoulders and knowing that nature will respond pretty directly to your idiocy. I think that going back to the beginning, it does help fortify your identity in really healthy ways.
Yeah, it's I think you want to find places where you can be yourself, right? And sometimes nature really allows you to do that,
or just at least generally in
at least
life.
It gives you a little bit of space to figure out yourself.
That's a good guiding principle for life. Just try and find places where you can be yourself.
Yeah, because, well, there's a lot of times you don't, for a variety of reasons, you don't get to entirely be yourself, you know, or just be, like, comfortable. And I think nature, like, kind of allows you to do that. There's just sort of less layers that you can put over stuff, or less layers of expectation. And that's one thing I would say I doubt a lot, is that it's also a privilege that not everybody gets. Not everybody gets to have that opportunity to go into nature, feel comfortable, and be able to be their self. So I think that's something we shouldn't take for granted. And then it's incumbent upon us to protect those opportunities to be yourself and enable people that don't get those opportunities to be able to get there.
Hell yeah. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy that you've been at the helm at Save the Waves for the last decade. I get the fucking house analogy was fire, man.
Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah, you can build a house with us.
Dude, put that in some marketing materials.
Yeah, we got it recorded for Emmett, so he'll be happy, and Lauren will like that. She could take it and run with it. But thank you for putting me at the helm. And yeah,
I merely going. Showed you that there was a boat, an unmanned boat over there. They needed a captain. I do think that, as you mentioned, surfing can be a very self-centered and performative sport that is very much in the milieu of scarcity and selfishness. And I think that conservation and learning about and getting involved with organizations like Save the Waves can provide perspective and can allow it can be a tool for mental health, actually.
Oh, totally.
To get involved with an environmental organization and kind of begin to see yourself within this larger context of an ecosystem and watch positive change happen, watch places be saved, be preserved, and know that you are a part of that. It's a really powerful human experience. It's been great for me to, you know, cheer on from the sidelines, and I just am a damn big fan of what you're doing.
Well, thank you. I like getting a chance to chat through with you. If we had the microphones or not, I appreciate always a chance to talk with you and catch up. And I hope you just continue to be stay involved with us as we embark, because this is 20 years also of Say the Waves. 10 years of Nick, but it's 20 years of Say the Waves.
Wow.
So next year is going to be a big year. And so we want to keep you involved and keep you as part of our coalition.
Absolutely. So, and where can people get involved?
We can go to savethewaves.org, and you can check us on the socials at Save the Waves Coalition is the Instagram, and I believe similar on Facebook for all of you boomers. Apparently boomers go on Facebook.
Yeah. All right.
I don't think I'm a boomer, but I'm somewhere in there.
No.
I know about Facebook.
Yeah. So make it's meta now, bro. Nick Strong-Svetich, you're a gentleman and a scholar. Try not to do those 360 years as much, or as with as much gusto, and maybe one day you'll finally stick one.
I think that window's closed, but I'll go out there and have fun.
Dare to dream.
Yeah.
There's also just like a high dose psychedelic trip that you could take where you just think about it and it's just as good as the real thing, I swear.
That's how my son had learned how to ski. Yeah. He was like
on a high dose psychedelic trip?
Well, not the psychedelic part, but I go, okay, you want to go skiing? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, well, let me show you. And he's like, I already know how. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah. Uncle Luke told me I could teach myself anything if I think about it enough. So I did. And I'm like, you taught yourself how to ski? And he's like, yep. And I go, okay, well, we'll put the skis on. We'll see how you do. And I'm thinking like, well, this will be humbling. He's going to just smash himself and get destroyed. He puts the skis on and he goes, zip, zip. Two turns down to the bottom, stops, and I go, well, you really know how to ski? You know yourself. So, anyways, we'll wrap on that one. Thank you for everything you do. And bring the potty back. Yeah.
The squatty potty. It's coming back.
All right.
See ya. That's our show. Before you head off into your day, click the link below and sign up for my Substack newsletter. Every Friday, I send one newsletter with a new word that I learned or think is cool and write a little something about that word. So if you love growing your vocabulary, if you're the kind of weirdo who thinks that reading is sexy, click the link below or go to tierman.substack.com. That's tierman.substack.com to sign up for the weekly newsletter. Thank you to everyone who donates to this podcast via Substack. I rely on listeners like you to keep this thing going. So if you have some extra change, if this is the kind of thing that you want to support, I very much appreciate those paid subscriptions. And if you don't have the cash, just sign up for it for free. No big deal. Go be a good person. Get out into the water, whatever body of water is closest to you. Lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.